This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be on what is a barrister, what do they do, and demystifying the bar. I am here today with barrister Miss Joanna Hardy from Red Lion Chambers in London. Joanna is an approachable, experienced and diligent barrister who has been praised by the Legal 500 as having a sure touch with clients and the court alike. She is regularly instructed to advise and act in cases involving difficult points of law, and she is instructed by both the defence and prosecution. Thank you for joining us, Joanna.
Thank you for having me, Hattie.
Marvellous. Right, so this is an area which I have been itching to do for a very long time, because we talk about these terms because we know what they mean to us, but we want to explain to our listeners basically the world of barristers.
Yeah.
So let's start with the first question. So tell me, Joanna, let's talk about what does a barrister do?
So a barrister is a lawyer starting at the very basic level. And we find barristers in mainly common law jurisdictions. So here in England and Wales, in Canada, in Australia. And barristers are often specialised, particular areas of law, and they're highly trained. They appear mainly in court, and their particular skill is known as courtroom advocacy, so speaking in court. But another skill that many paper-based barristers have is the provision of quite specialist advice. So a barrister might specialise in crime, like I do. They might specialise in employment, in family, or in commercial law. But they're specialist lawyers, often but not always instructed by a solicitor to conduct a particular case.
Yes, and we also have what the term is used, direct access barristers.
We do.
So that means that essentially the public can come directly to a barrister without having to go through a law firm, without having to go through a solicitor, and instruct the barrister directly. Not all barristers practice like that, do they?
They don't.
Some
so
do.
You have to be particularly qualified in direct access work. So you have to go on a course in order to be direct access qualified.
Yes.
And only certain cases are suitable for direct access work.
Yes,
it's
indeed.
Right to say that in those circumstances and in certain cases, a member of the public can directly instruct a barrister.
Yes, I mean, we've had situations where barristers actually say, we do need a law firm to be involved because there's a lot of paperwork, there's a lot of administrative side to this case, or, you know, and they need that assistance because barristers are fantastic with the paperwork, you know, we all know that, but they just need that extra assistance with getting it all together, putting things in order, managing the client barrister relationship. But yes, now that's we're going off into direct access now. Okay, so what's the main differences between a barrister and a solicitor?
So traditionally, a solicitor will instruct a barrister to advise or act in a case. So solicitors tend to be the first port of call for clients in those circumstances. One analogy, it's not perfect, but it's not bad, it's like seeing your GP and then being referred to a specialist. Although it's right to say that many solicitors are specialists in their own right. The solicitor would instruct, and we use the word brief a barrister. So if you ever hear somebody say, that's my brief, they're referring to their barrister, to do things like draft a document or appear in a case. And in those circumstances, you act as a team. And increasingly, that teamwork can involve a crossover between roles. So some solicitors now have higher rights. They're known as solicitor advocates. And they can do some of the work that you might traditionally think were barristers. And vice versa, we've touched upon direct access. Some barristers are now authorised to conduct what we call litigation, so the meat of getting a case together and presenting it. So there's new models of working emerging, but traditionally a solicitor would be the first port of call, and they would engage in the general preparation of the case, gathering witness statements, taking proofs of evidence, and instructing a barrister to advise on particular points of law and to present the case in court.
Yes, okay, that's very, very helpful. Next question, why are barristers sometimes referred to as counsel? Is there a difference between this term and the name barrister? And I've certainly had sort of clients, so I can see on their faces, they're thinking, well, what's the counsel? And is that the barrister? And so why is that? Why do they refer to barristers like that?
Counsel is just another word for a barrister. There's no magic to it. There's no secret to it. It can be confusing in court because counsel can be the singular. So if a judge says, I'm going to address defence counsel, he might be talking to me. If the judge were to say, I'd like to address counsel, it's also a plural because he'd mean everyone in the case. Singular or collective, it just means a barrister.
It just means a barrister. Okay. Now, big question for those student listeners that we may have. How do you become a barrister?
I used to say slowly and quite expensively, but I'm hoping that now is easier. There are three stages to becoming a barrister in the traditional route.
And traditional route from education, school, college, university.
Exactly.
Right, okay.
So there's the academic stage, which will be to study a degree. Now, that degree might be in law or it might be in a different subject. The second stage is a vocational course, which is called the Bar Professional Training Course, the BPTC. I don't think anyone thought about pronouncing it when they did the other words. And that's a course that prepares you for life as a barrister. And then a work or on-the-job part of qualifying, which is what we call a pupillage.
Yes.
So if your listeners hear reference to a pupil or a pupil barrister, it's a barrister in training. It's quite similar to an apprenticeship.
Yes.
So they're the three stages. If somebody decides not to do a law degree, and many don't do law degrees, some of the best barristers I know studied history or politics and all sorts of things.
Yes.
They do need to do an extra year, which is a conversion. And that's a course called the GDL, the Graduate Diploma in Law, which just tops up their legal knowledge. And then everyone's on an even footing for the Bar Professional Training Course. There are two areas of caution about becoming a barrister, which I think is always a health warning that does need to be given. And that's, number one, it is very competitive. And number two, it can be expensive. There are remedies
there. Industry, Joanne, every industry is competitive, isn't it?
It is.
I actually don't know an industry at the moment or a market at the moment, certainly not in the UK, where you can think, oh, that's not competitive and that's going to be really
I'll breeze
good.
In.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
Yeah. I mean, this is a higher level because obviously you're taking a different kind of responsibility than going into perhaps the banking environment and working on corporate mergers or acquisitions or going into the pharmaceutical industry and saying, I'm going to open up or work in a chemist or in a you know, hospital behind the scenes. A little bit different to that, of course.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it is particularly competitive on the numbers. So we have several hundred applicants for maybe two places.
In terms of the pupillage element of it. But there's about 16,500 practising barristers, I think that's
there
the
are.
Last number I saw at the moment.
Yep.
And there's about 150-something thousand practising solicitors. But it's how good you are, right, and how dedicated you are to your cause. You've got to love this profession to be brilliant at it.
You really do. It's a real vocation. So
yes.
If you're not waking up in the morning and loving what you do, it's an incredibly hard slog.
Yes.
And
it's hard work being a barrister. I don't think it's the kind of job that you say, well, I've done my 9 to 5, I'll go home and just chill out. Because if you've got a case that you've just been instructed for the next day, you really need to get your gear together.
You do. You need to be a real go-getter and a self-starter. And I think for your student listeners, if they don't have those qualities, really don't do it to yourself, because you will spend your working life dragging yourself
through. Don't let
through.
The parents convince you unless you're convinced first.
If you're not jumping out of bed in the morning, you're willing to put in the early starts, the late nights, the travel, and quite high intensity, but also high stakes work for citizens and sometimes vulnerable citizens. It's a higher degree of responsibility, a huge amount of work, but it's a wonderful way to spend a life if if that's what you want to do.
It's very rewarding. I mean, being in the legal profession myself, I find it incredibly rewarding when you get the results. You put your hard work in and you get the results. And sometimes it's not about win or lose in the legal world, is it? I mean, some clients come and say, I want to win this case, but it's not that type of case. It's about getting the best results, maybe the best compromise
exactly
that you can find in the situation. And one of the points that I'd like to mention is that all barristers are self-employed.
Most barristers are self-employed. Some barristers now are in employed practice. They're in-house. Exactly.
Yeah.
But at the independent bar in chambers, we're a collection of self-employed individuals.
Yes. So you have the chambers. So, for example, this is Red Lion Chambers.
Yeah.
And then every barrister belongs to the chambers, but they're actually self-employed individuals with their own insurance policies.
Precisely.
And I think that's very interesting as well. So, okay, so now for a bit of a fun question, because I think it's come up a lot in terms of the most frequently asked questions.
Yeah.
So why do some barristers wear wigs and black cloaks in court?
Okay, so,
and why do some not? Are they disrespecting the court? You know, let's explain that.
So we get asked this a lot, and I get asked this when I have many peoples with me. They're always quite interested in my wig and my gown.
She's not wearing one
by
the way.
They wear it all the time. And like lots of things in this job, it boils down to tradition. So the gowns trace quite a long way back, and they simply derived from the fashion of the time in centuries gone by. But the wigs, they are only traced back to the 17th century, when it was quite trendy, and it's quite unbelievable to think this. It was quite trendy to wear the wigs outside of court as well as inside of court. Powdered wigs for men, and back then all barristers were men, were fashionable because men were losing their hair due to health conditions and horrible things like lice. I'm pleased to say that's not the reason why we do it now.
Yes, you won't find any lice in the wigs these days.
I really, really hope not. But it's part of a uniform then, and it's stuck. But now,
for the criminal bar only, right?
So certain proceedings, I mean, I'm a criminal barrister and we always wear our wigs and gowns. We take them off for example, child witnesses sometimes can be a little bit intimidated by them. So sometimes we take them off.
Do we know when that came into play, where you take them off for child witnesses?
It was fairly recently as a special measure. I imagine that always under a discretion the judge could say it. But much more recently it's become much more regular.
Yes. Yeah.
So there are other reasons why we retain them now that are more than fashion, because they're not very fashionable and they're a pain to lug about the court.
Well, it's not just that. It would ruin your hair. I mean, if I had to put on a wig for half of my working day, I would look like the Lion King when I take it off. You know?
Sometimes it's quite handy if you haven't washed your hair, because you can cover it up.
Yes.
But now it marks the seriousness and the solemnity of the occasion. So being in court is rarely a happy experience, particularly in criminal courts. You know, we're in the business of human misery. And it also helps a little
bit. You did say enjoy your job, didn't you?
I do, I love it, yes.
But,
it is a solemn occasion. It's often quite serious subject matter, and it can really help with marking out the solemnity of the occasion. It's also, this sounds silly, it also helps, I've found, with marking ourselves out between our professional and personal lives. So if I've spent 6 hours engaged in quite a heated cross-examination with somebody who probably leaves court not thinking that I'm a particularly nice person, and then I get on the tube and sometimes they're in the same carriage and they don't recognise me because I look
really
so different without my wig on and without my bands on and without my gown
on. I want to see you with your wig on, Joanna.
We're not doing a photo of that for the podcast.
Yes. No, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
And it also, I guess, gives the barrister that opportunity to say, right, I'm out of this scene now, you know. But I think it depends on the court that you're in as well. So civil barristers, family court, for example, you don't wear wigs.
Yeah, and in the Supreme Court, when we saw the country was gripped by the Supreme Court legislation with Brexit, the lawyers weren't wearing wigs and gowns in our highest court. So they've been retained in certain areas and not in others. But some people want to abolish them in the criminal court, so I'm a big fan of my wig and gown. I'm quite sentimental about it, so I always resist those calls.
Well, thank you. That's a great explanation on that. We've touched on how many barristers are currently working in the UK. We said about 16,500.
Yeah.
So let's go to our next question that's been sent in for us to ask. It says, do I have to have a legal matter that is in court to take advice from a barrister, or can I instruct a barrister to give me advice very early on and before any legal proceedings are issued? Now, I just want to mention, in my law firm, we instruct barristers very, very early on because we believe in getting the highest legal opinion that we can, even if the matter is not contentious and, you know, people are not arguing and about to issue court proceedings or not, to get the strategy right for the case. And then if it does become unfortunate and it becomes contentious or court proceedings are issued, at least you've started out on the path of that legal matter with the advice, the highest legal advice that you can get, a strategy in place.
Yeah.
And if you do revisit the barrister again, the barrister's had the opportunity to guide that case rather than it landing on their desk a week before it ends up in court or a couple of months when a lot of the work has been done. So that's one of the questions that people want to know. Can they come to barristers before a matter is in court or not?
So the answer is yes. You can seek advice from a barrister at any stage. I do a lot of legal aid work, and payments for barristers pre-court proceedings aren't available. So that's an interesting point there.
So legal aid no more pays barristers for any legal work prior to the hearing.
Yes, so if somebody is simply under investigation, for example, they hadn't been charged, legal aid wouldn't pay for me, for example, to advise them. But solicitors who have legal aid contracts, they are available. So that support is there and they do fantastic work.
Yes, this is obviously pre-charge. We're talking about, well, on criminal.
Exactly.
Sort of,
yes. You're referencing in terms of civil cases and the strategy early on and front-loading that advice and making sure a case is on the right path.
But you can do that even if you're involved in a criminal matter. You can go and privately pay to come to a barrister very early on. Maybe you're waiting to be charged, maybe you're just been charged, and prior to the court proceedings, even if you do qualify for legal aid further down the road, you could still come and see a barrister early
on. So in certain circumstances, you could instruct a barrister. Sometimes people are anxious about the proceedings and they just want to know what their options are, what their prospects are early on. So,
and it's such a shame because the legal aid cuts, and this is one of the reasons why Get Legally Speaking exists in a way, because the legal aid cuts have been sort of 80% has been cut out. And it's quite sad, I find, that people can't take advice prior to a court hearing. That's a very long way down the line, isn't it?
So
really?
they obviously have the benefit of solicitors, and if they're in the police station under arrest, they can have a duty solicitor or their own solicitor if they have one. So that is available. Often in my line of work, the information available early is actually very scant, whereas I'm sure in civil cases, you know, the lie of the land a little bit more.
Yes.
So it may be a difference between the civil and the criminal areas in terms of front-loading your preparation and putting the case on the right track. But certainly I can see the benefit in the strategy you've identified, particularly for civil cases.
Yes. No, I hear you. And I certainly would say, you know, where you can, certainly take advice of a barrister as early on as you can, even if the matter is not contentious, because you could get golden guidance from, again, I say, the highest legal opinion that you could find. And that's why my law firm really specialises around that, because it could change the landscape of that legal case a lot. It could in some cases mean that it doesn't become contentious and it doesn't end up in court because you've written the correct correspondence from the beginning to the other side, you've engaged on the right level. And I find that barristers have a huge value to cases, non-contentious or otherwise, because of that. So I'm a converted believer. There you are. Okay, so what does a barrister's clerk do? So barristers have clerks. What does a barrister's clerk do?
So my clerks would say they do everything.
clean my shoes, man.
No, I don't mean that. I mean they do everything that's important to me. I wouldn't ask them to make me
scones.
Coffee. They'd laugh at me.
And croissants.
So the opposite of that, they're central to the system of any chambers. They attract and deal with the work that comes in. They recommend barristers for that work, or they might allocate work to barristers. They deal with our day-to-day diaries, they deal with the courts, they deal with other parties to help with court dates, they deal with my fees and my billing, and they help with managing every corner of our practice.
They are really key, aren't they?
Oh, they
to
are.
Sets of chambers. And sometimes I don't, because I know a lot of clerks, and sometimes I find that clerks are not given the recognition that they deserve. I mean, is there an award ceremony for clerks?
There should be.
Shouldn't there be?
I mean, they also become part of your lives because you speak to them every single day.
Yeah.
Sometimes I speak to my clerk, you know, 2-3 times a day. You have to tell them when you're having a stressful time and you can't perhaps take on a huge case, or if you've got other commitments or things going on in your lives. So it's a really interesting relationship. They're just crucial. They're, you know, part agent, part manager, part friend.
Do the clerks choose the barristers, or do the barristers get automatically allocated to clerks? So because that's an interesting...
Yeah, different chambers have different systems. So some chambers allocate one clerk for a call band. So they'll say, barristers under 5 years call, this is your clerk.
Right.
Barristers 5 to 10 years call, this is your clerk.
Right.
In these chambers, we do have allocations of obviously their duties, but they tend to... cover everyone, and it tends to be who's been engaged last in the query that you have or what they've been helping you with. So it works really well here, and our clerks room is really the heart of this chambers.
Yes I know a few of your clerks, and they're wonderful people. I've known them for quite a few years.
Yeah.
I mean, what I have noticed, which I think is actually quite cute, if I must say, is that the majority of clerks are men. And what fascinates me actually the most is they're so organized. Super organized people, and the men in my life are not so organized. So when we, you know, very early on when I entered the legal profession, and I thought, wow, there's a room full of men here, they are on top of their diaries, the chambers run so smoothly, they're just like super PAs, really.
There's so much more than PAs. They're just brilliant, and I don't know how they do their job. I couldn't. If I sat in that seat for 5 minutes and tried to organise the diaries of 100 people.
It's not just the diaries, as you said, there's so many. Some clerks have a lot of barristers to look after.
They
I mean, you've got chambers with over 100, 150 barristers, and they have a lot of people to look after.
They do. And we have two sites as well. We have an annex out in Essex. So it's an extraordinary task, and they're dealing with court lists that change last minute. They're dealing with different parties, different lawyers, and they manage it fantastically. They're juggling a lot of balls.
They smooch all the lawyers, they make sure everyone's smoothed over, and it's great. No, I have a lot of respect for clerks, because I think they've got a tough gig, because they have to deal with all the personalities of their barristers.
They do.
And we've all got different personalities, and we've all got different levels of work and things like that.
Yeah.
And they also have to deal with the outside clients as well.
They do. And
they're shop front.
They
as
are.
Well.
And it's quite high intense. Yeah, it's quite a high intensity environment as well. Our clerks are fantastic, and we do have female clerks here, and
yes.
It is a
there
wonderful
are female clerks
room.
By the way. Yes,
it
is a wonderful... It's just more male than female. I find
it's a really wonderful profession, and it's a real skill that they have. And it's not a skill that I would have, I don't think.
Well, the interesting thing is that you don't actually have to have a specific qualification to become a barrister's clerk. And I think if I were to be in another life and choose another profession, I would love to be a barrister's clerk.
Yeah.
Because the responsibility that comes with it is great, and you don't have had to be a university graduate. You know, it's a profession that I don't know how they get their jobs. I actually think it's word of mouth when there's a space to come about. And the other interesting thing I find with clerks is they very rarely move chambers.
Mm.
Unlike most professions, where the average, I think I read, the average time in a job is 3 years.
Gosh.
At the moment in the city, which is not that long.
It's not long
at all. But clerks work for years in sets of chambers and very rarely move.
Yeah, I don't think I'd ever let my clerks go. I think I'd block the door and try and lock them in.
Their croissants are too nice. No, when you're joking. Okay, so I'm going to try and squeeze in two more questions,
okay.
Joanna, because this is lots of fun and I'm really enjoying it. And I think there's a lot more questions that we can go through. But one of the next question I want to ask is, what is the difference between a QC and a barrister? And we say the junior barrister, because that's what you are if you're not a QC. So what's a QC? First of all, let's tell everybody it's Queen's Counsel.
It is. So a Queen's Counsel is a barrister who's been selected for that particular title due to their skills, excellence and experience. So they're the top of the top, the creme de la creme of the profession. And it can take people many years to attain that status. Some do it quite quickly.
And they have to be recommended, don't they? They can't just say, I'll make an application to become a Queen's Counsel because my work has been excellent over the years. They have to be very carefully selected.
So they do apply. I think it's an application process, but you're right, the selection process thereafter is incredibly intense for those who apply. And the fact that that leaves us with profession where it's QCs and juniors can lead to the perception that a junior barrister is someone straight out of work experience.
It does give you that. I mean, this is one of the things I've always wondered. Why do they do junior barrister? Because the seniority comes with the experience and the years and what you've got to undo about in terms of cases and how you've performed. So I actually only refer to junior barristers for 5-year call under.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the phrase that's used, but a junior barrister technically could be somebody who's 40 years called, who just hasn't happened to have applied.
For 40 years as a barrister.
So yeah, unless and until any of us take Silk, we are junior barristers. And then our creme de la creme are QCs.
Yes.
And we call that taking Silk because traditionally their gowns are Silk gowns. So if any of your listeners go to court and they see a barrister dressed slightly differently in a slightly different gown, and they're particularly good, chances are they're a QC.
Yes, because I mean, I have sometimes, we have clients calling us up and saying, I need a QC, because they have this idea that if somebody's not a QC, then a junior barrister is junior in their work. But that's not the case. And I think it's really important to remember that. And I think it's worth also mentioning that QC, the reason why it's Queen's Counsel is because we have a queen as a head of state rather than a king.
Yep.
So when that changes, it'll be Casey. And will all the QCs become Caseys or will they remain QCs?
Sure, I don't know. We'll have to check that.
I've wondered that, but I'm sure we can find that somewhere.
They'll be outraged. They'll have to change all the names on the door.
Yeah, no, indeed. No, and then just time for one last question, if that's all right, Joanna.
So, of course.
Who's the governing body for barristers? What is the governing body for barristers?
So we have the General Council of the Bar. We call them the Bar Council. And they are our general representative group across all practice areas, all barristers. Then we have the Bar Standards Board, which regulate barristers. So they're the barrister police, as it were. They're a government body. Yeah, they deal with qualifications. So if somebody hasn't qualified properly and they're practicing or they haven't got a practicing certificate, they deal with all of the qualification side of things. They also deal with complaints. So if a client, professional or a lay client, complains about a barrister and it falls within their ambit, they deal with complaints about barristers as well, and that can lead to disciplinary hearings. They hold hearings where disciplinary matters are discussed. So it's a tightly regulated profession. We are expected to uphold the highest standards, and they're there to ensure that backstop, to ensure that everybody in the profession is abiding by our code of conduct. And our code of conduct is simply a set of rules that we apply to each situation that we're presented with.
Yes.
And it's a guiding concept, as it were. So what it's meant to be is a fluid document where you can look at your problem and think, what are my professional rules about this? And it tends to work quite well.
Yeah.
Our biggest phone call that we get in chambers, I'm 10 years call now, when junior barristers ring us, it's often not about the law and often not about their cases. It's often about an ethical problem. So quite often you might be presented with a set of circumstances where a junior barrister just doesn't have the experience to think this is what the professional and right thing to do is here.
Yes.
And
you can take guidance.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of being in a chambers like these, because we have, you know, Silks who've been in practice for decades, and then our brand new
very talented this chambers junior. Has gone to work the old head of chambers has
Max
gone
Hill.
To work, has gone
yeah,
so to work for the government.
Yeah, so he's the director of public prosecutions now.
Yes.
We're all really proud of him. He was an amazing barrister at the bar, and he now is the director of public prosecutions. So yeah, people go on to do different things. Some of our QCs and senior practitioners are appointed as judges, but like any organisation, it's a bit like a family. You know, you always have a phone call where you can. Even now, I ring people and say, "This has happened. Yes. What do I do?"
Yes.
And it's the beauty of the profession. It's really supportive and collegiate.
Excellent. Okay. Well, that's all we have time for today, but thank you ever so much.
Thank you for having me.
Really appreciate your time. I'm looking forward to part two.
Yeah.
I've got questions buzzing around in my head, and a whole list of questions sitting next to me that we haven't had the time to go through. But don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts, and you can find us on Twitter, Facebook and LinkedIn by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you very much for listening.